If you've been used to earning a steady income as an employee at an architect's practice, the idea of setting up your own business in architecture, whilst exciting, might also feel overwhelming and frankly a bit scary. So how did architectural designer Ian Knowles overcome his fears to start his own practice? And what preparation did he do to set up his architecture business? That's exactly what we're going to be chatting about in this episode of Architecture Business Club, a weekly podcast for solo and small firm architecture practice owners just like you who want to build a profitable, future-proof architecture business that fits around their life. I'm the host, John Clayton, and if you want a business in architecture that gives you more freedom, flexibility and fulfillment, then go to architecturebusinessclub.com/blueprint and download the Architecture Business Blueprint. It's the step-by-step formula to freedom for architects, architectural technologists, and architectural designers, and it's absolutely free as a gift from me. Now, let's talk about Ian's experiences setting up his new business in architecture. Ian Knowles is a Norfolk-based architectural designer and the director of Iconic Architecture, with over 10 years in architecture and construction and a background in architectural stonemasonry. Iconic Architecture specializes in residential architecture, from unlocking space in existing homes to bespoke new build dwellings. You can learn more about Ian at iconic-architecture.co.uk. Ian, welcome to Architecture Business Club.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm glad you could find the time to have a chat with me today. Ian, tell me about how your home renovations going. You've got a 1930s property you've been working on for a while, haven't you?
It's a challenge. I'm learning much more about certain aspects of 1930s construction than I really probably want to, but it's good. It's good fun. I've learned to hang doors and bits of plaster work and all sorts. And yeah, learning that everything doesn't quite line up in an old property.
Certainly doesn't. So it sounds like you're quite hands-on with this project.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I've got a background in stonemasonry, so I've always got a kind of a, oh, I could probably do that. Yes, I can. Sometimes it takes me an awful lot longer than I really want to. One of the doors, most of the doors were fine because they're like 1930s. They open into the room. I didn't really want them. That kind of messes up the circulation. So I flipped them. So they open to get to the door. Most of them are fine. One of them is just not square. The floor isn't level. Then we put carpet in. I ended up taking off so much of this door, and it's fine now. But you know, half the door is in the bin because I've either scraped or sawed or just kind of botched it into the existing door opening. But it works. It's good.
It reminds me of the second property that we bought as a family. It was a 1960s semi, and it needed everything doing to it. It just reminds me of that. And I'll let you in the little secret if you didn't realize already, but they are never finished. Like, you just get to the point where you think you've got it all done, and then you'll be starting again. So it's going to be an ongoing project, I suspect, for some time. We are going to talk about your recent experiences setting up your practice, Iconic Architecture, so that anybody else that's thinking about setting up their own architecture practice can benefit from your experience on this. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I think it's going to be really interesting. It can feel quite scary, though, leaving a salaried position and starting a new practice. So what was your biggest fear before going it alone?
For a lot of my career, I just didn't even think about it. I just didn't think it was a thing I could do. You know, it's kind of that fear of finding the clients, of it working, all the pressure. I think it's a mixture of those. It's just, it's the reality of running a business. Finding the work was probably my biggest fear. Probably still is my biggest fear, but it's, the position of kind of agency about it now is different.
Got it. Yeah. I would imagine that's probably one of the common fears that most practice owners have when they're first looking to start out. Obviously, there's a lot of practical stuff that needs to be done, but that fear of, am I going to have enough work? Where's the work going to come from? That's something that a lot of people will have experienced that are listening to this episode, I'm sure. So it's going to really resonate with people. One thing that you did do, though, in preparation, you did write a business plan before you launched your business. So could you tell me about what key elements that included and perhaps how that's helped so far?
It's a really important thing of stepping out of being kind of an employee and thinking about what your business wants to be, how you want to run your business. You know, lots of different sort of templates or methods to produce one, but it really refines down what your business is, who your competitors, what are your key performance things you want to look at, how do you want to market yourself? And also, really importantly, you're starting to look at the financial side. What's your cash flow plan? And that can be very different from your experience in practice. Thinking about what your base rates, your finances are. Suddenly, it's not just how much you're getting paid. It's your software, your insurances, the downtime. Everything's got to be factored in for it to be a viable business. I think that is a snapshot of it.
It's really interesting. I recall that when I worked in practices previously before I set up my own business, that sometimes we'd see the rates, like our rate that we got charged out at, and it was usually multiple times more than the wages that we received. And it was always that thing of like, wow, they're charging this much money for my time. I should be getting paid more. And I think probably was a bit of naivety there from most of us employees as to, you do need to charge. I'm sure that in doing your business plan, you're crunching those numbers thinking, well, you've got to cover all those expenses. You've got to allow for the fact that you aren't going to be fee earning 100% of your time while you're working. So yeah, it's quite a sobering exercise looking at those numbers for sure. Yeah. A very useful one.
There's a side of it as well. It's like, as an employee, you might see your charge out rate or your hourly rate, and there'll be a huge difference. But you know, the business cost is probably somewhere between 1.5 and 2 for your salary. So, you know, instantly the distance between the two isn't that much. And I'm keeping myself quite lean at the moment. I'm working from home. I'm doing a lot of the marketing and all those sorts of things myself. So I'm not having those outlay costs. But as a business grows, becomes more viable, you have to hand those kind of hats off and start having a wider kind of system to do marketing and do lead generation, do your website. Otherwise, your time, your valuable time, is split up too much that you can't run the business effectively.
So in the beginning, when you're starting out, you've probably got more time than money available. So it does make sense to do a lot more of those tasks yourself. But as your practice grows, then that time, you've only got a finite amount of it, whereas in theory, we can always earn more money. So that's sort of having that strategy about outsourcing or hiring once more work comes in and you get more established is a good approach. But yeah, I think a lot of people probably DIY pretty much everything in the beginning, and some of us probably DIY things for a bit too long and actually stifle the growth of our businesses potentially. We don't get taught how to run a business at architecture school. So we could be forgiven for making a few mistakes along the way. So it is important to fill those knowledge gaps. And I feel that actually the responsibility is still on us to fill those knowledge gaps on the business side of architecture, even though we don't get taught it when we go to university or college. So I'm really interested to know how you have filled those knowledge gaps.
Yeah, it is so true at architecture school. You don't learn about the side of business, a bit like kind of technical stuff you don't learn. But I've been fortunate that one of the presses I worked for gave me quite a lot of exposure to the financial side, to financing, to doing fee proposals. And that has kind of given me a good baseline to kind of build off for my own practice. I think you've got to look and explore how people are doing it. One of those ways is doing it's finding podcasts online, listening to how other people do. Like your one is really good, and you've got some other business support systems in place to help people kind of have a blueprint for what to do next. There's a number of kind of architecture ones out there in the field, but then also it's useful to look outside of your business at how other people run businesses, because there's really important ways that, or really different ways you can approach the same problem. That's probably my advice.
Absolutely. So check out some of the resources that are available to us that are industry specific, but don't limit yourself to just resources specifically for architects or architecture practices, because there's actually some really valuable stuff out there that's whether it's kind of general business and marketing advice or advice for other industries that's still transferable and applicable to what we do.
Yeah. Also, I'd mention that, you know, for me, there's local schemes. So there's government run schemes. So locally, there's the BIPC. They run workshops, networking events. They have like online courses, and that has been useful to fill some gaps of that kind of research. I found that speaking to people, even just picking up reaching out to people either in your network or in, you know, business people, you know, speaking to them, do some research, and you go out and speak to some people, and they'll really help kind of put the jigsaw pieces together. And you'd be surprised at how often people are open to just having a coffee, you know, buying a coffee, and they'll have a chat with you, and it would be really valuable. It would almost be more valuable than your research, but you should also do your research so you can ask the right questions.
Yeah, I think most people are willing to help. As you say, like, if you've got an opportunity to get to some networking events, or you have an existing network of business connections, people that are already running their own business, then absolutely, yeah, go and meet them for a coffee and ask them a few questions, and most of them will be very glad to help out. And the other point you mentioned, which we don't want to overlook, is about the support through, you know, regional schemes. I also benefited from quite a bit of free support, actually, over the years. I think when I moved back up in Lancashire, initially I contacted a local agency through one of the councils, a business growth with a council, and got a load of support to help write a business plan. And in later years, accessed hours and hours of training courses, at in-person training that was all paid for and covered through, that one was the New Anglia Growth Hub. Give them a shout out. They'd had a lot of training courses available in East Anglia, but I'm sure there's the equivalent to, you know, other areas across the country too. Ian, you decided to set up as a limited company rather than a sole trader. What led you to that decision?
I think it's kind of a slightly more risk adverse option. The your finances are more tied to the limited company than they are to you personally, working as a sole trader. Also, I had a conversation with my contacts about career insurances, and his experience was, you know, from going from a sole trader to a limited company, he then had this quandary of how do you continue on your insurances, because they're tied to a different business entity. So for me, it's not a huge cost to run your own business. Okay, there are more kind of thing hoops to jump through, but I think it's a more viable long-term option. Especially if you want to be ambitious and kind of go for a sustainable large business, I think it's the best option, or larger business.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think when I decided to go limited, because I actually did start out as a sole trader many years ago, and it was upon advice from my accountant to go limited. He was asking about the nature of the work and how secure the broad work was going to be. Was it going to be repeating client work every month, or was it going to be kind of different projects and a number of different clients? And I think from the sort of risk point of view, given the nature of the work I was doing, it wasn't kind of repeat work that was regular. We decided that limited was the way to go for that limited liability. So I could totally understand why you've decided to make that choice now. So yeah, I think that's the right decision. Starting a new business, I mean, it can be costly, and income can be patchy at first. Do you have any tips on financing a new business?
So from my own experience, it was a cold start business. So I've sought out a startup loan, and that has helped me invest in some of the initial startup costs of computers and marketing efforts and items around that, which you also need, you know, you need a business plan and a cash flow plan to get that loan. I had started some initial discussions to get some work in line, but it ended up being more of a cold start than I was expecting. It's first 3 to 6 months of a business are going to be difficult. So if you can make some savings, you've got that. You've got a significant reduction in your stress. But I would say, you know, you've got to find some sort of financial model and also have some plan B's and C's. You know, how are you going to finance your life if the money runs out? You just have that in place that should certain things happen that you can go, right, this isn't working, I'm going to go do some part-time. When this isn't working, I'm going to work for a practice contract for 6 months to build up, to make sure that the bills are paid and you are not driving yourself into the ground. It's always going to be a struggle. And everyone I speak to is like, the start of a business is always a struggle. And you kind of got to aim for getting to about a year and things will start mellowing. But, you know, it's probably not. I'm kind of thinking 3 years is the time where things are like, okay, that's kind of, it's now running, it's now a business, it's now a thing. I don't think there's not kind of one solution. It's just, you've got to kind of have a bit of faith in yourself.
So one of the things that you mentioned there is there's the opportunity for a startup loan to help get things started so that you can invest in the equipment that you need to be able to do your job and to get everything that you need to get started. You mentioned again about your business plan, that you'd done some financial forecasting. So that sounds like another sensible thing that people can do. And you also mentioned about having some contingency plans, which I think is a really good idea. So having a plan B, you have your forecasts, but then you have a plan B, maybe even there's the plan C, so that if things don't go quite as well as expected with your forecast, that you've got some other options there. So I think that's a really kind of sensible approach. And I think also what you mentioned, that idea of maybe it not really being a business for the first couple of years or so, that it's going to take you maybe up to 2-3 years to kind of get to where you want to get to. And that's refreshing, because I think sometimes we sort of think, right, I'm in business now, I'm going to, like, the work's just going to start coming in and it's going to be happy days and all of that. And it can take a little bit of time to get going and get established. So it's having some realistic targets and realistic goals to work towards and just making sure that you're focusing on just making some steady progress. So it's been really interesting to hear what you've been doing there. There's many different skills that are needed to set up and run a business, particularly if you're doing this on your own, as most people perhaps will do when they're starting out, unless it's a partnership business. But a lot of people are starting out as like sole practitioners in the industry. How did you decide what to do yourself and what to outsource?
I've done a lot myself, to be honest. I've decided to, at this moment, my time is, you know, is free, essentially. It's reduced cost, where I can just go, like, this time is down to marketing, or this time, this is just, I can assign that in my head, because otherwise it's just a pure cost that I don't have. It's not, you know, the business kind of cash flow security to start outsourcing things. It's kind of have that responsibility of, no, I have to pay that bill. The job's been done, but it's, if the money's not there, the money's not there. So I've kept it really lean, and it's leaner than probably I want to be. But, you know, there's kind of a plan in place that as things start becoming more secure, the cash flow in the pipeline builds, then I will start seeking out the next stage to take those hats off me. So it frees up my time to be the value add, which is where I'm going to add most value. And then I'm going to end up reaping the rewards in the long term for that. I'm not going to burn myself out either, which is the other potential danger.
That sounds like a very sensible approach. Have you given some consideration to some of the first tasks or responsibilities or roles within your business that you would like to delegate? Are there certain things already in the first sort of month or so that you're thinking, oh, you know what? I know I've got to do this, but it's not filling me with joy. Are there any things in particular that you're sort of thinking would be the first to outsource in the future? Remember, don't forget to download the Architecture Business Blueprint, the step-by-step formula to freedom for architects, architectural technologists, and architectural designers. You can grab the blueprint without any charge at architecturebusinessclub.com/blueprint. And if you're enjoying this episode, then please leave a 5-star review or rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Now back to the show.
It's, I think, accountancy. Accountants is a, you know, I've shifted it probably to an end of year cost rather than to a monthly reduced cost. And I think that's going to be one of my initial ones that I'm just going to have to take a hit on. And it's whether that happens mid-year or the end of the year, because it's not a skill, and there's lots of value and stress that can be taken away from that, because that is going to be one of the biggest things, especially at the end of year, that's going to negatively impact my business and potentially going to cost me more than it costs employing them. So it's an easy win, that one.
I would agree with that one. I actually, when I started out in practice, one of the very first things that was outsourced to somebody else was the accounting. I did bookkeeping in-house, but I paid for a cloud-based accounting software on a monthly subscription. So I did do that myself, but we're using a really easy-to-use online platform. But the actual sorting out the company accounts, tax returns, all of that stuff, I outsourced all of that from day one, because I was just like, this is just not my area of expertise. And I was just, would have been so worried about getting something wrong. I just thought, that's just one thing that I'm just happy to pay for, because I didn't want the stress.
Yeah, like you, I'm already using an online platform, and it's kind of putting the processes in place, because if you don't put them in now, when life is maybe stressful but easier, that as soon as life becomes harder and stressful, your habits will slip. So I think definitely they're going to be worth investing in. And then after that, I don't know how the business is going to grow. It's going to be a shift of what's costing me more than is returning the benefit. So that is potentially admin kind of lead generation elements, and kind of project management, and whether or not that is more of a project management system where it just means that I'm only inputting the data once. So I'm not using spreadsheets here, and you're trying to add data, really, like, have I done that? I can see kind of value payback on that, reducing that time, and then have to see how everything else grows. Websites, kind of social media elements, it's kind of things that in the future will be easier to take that hat off and hand to someone else, because so many of these things, you need the consistency. You need someone working on it week by week to maintain kind of your brand image or whatever KPI you want for it. You need that consistency and that effort. And it's at that time is quickly going to get absorbed with doing the job and doing the work.
Absolutely. I think something just worth mentioning actually is before you outsource or hire, is to always just go back to that task list, all those different roles and responsibilities that you have within your business, and then playing devil's advocate and just questioning whether everything's absolutely essential or not, and then going through like a process of elimination, getting rid of some of the things that maybe aren't serving your business, because things can change. There can be something that feels like it's working for some time, and then, 6 months down the line, you're still doing it and not getting the results from it. So there can be things you can just stop doing altogether. And then I think automation, you mentioned there about, project management system, automate before delegate, and then the sort of delegation and outsourcing or hiring, that should be the kind of last option after you've gone through that exercise. You've got You've got time to figure all that out because it's still early days yet. We'll talk a little bit about your area of specialism, your niche. So your specialism is it's residential architecture, and you plan to expand into retrofit and sustainability. Tell me a little bit about those areas, and also why do you think it's important to have a specialism in the first place? Because you know, it could have just been like general architecture, we do everything. So why hone in on those particular specialisms?
Architecture isn't, say, crowded market, but once you do your business plan, you'll look at your competitors and you'll look at that there's kind of tiers of competitors. There's the sole traders, there's, you know, you've got architects, technologists, you've got one-man bands, you've got small companies. You might get some companies up to kind of 10, you know, locally. Most of them aren't that big. There's a couple of bigger players, but they also work across the country. And how are you going to differentiate yourself in the market? How are you going to build a kind of brand about what you do that people can remember? Like, oh, that subject comes up, you know, one of them could be, for me, it's like retrofit. I think it's a really interesting subject. I think it's going to be a growing market. You see the numbers about the existing dwellings we've got and the ones that aren't achieving a good level of comfort and energy efficiency. Then there's going to, you know, that market is hopefully going to grow. And I can see a lot of opportunities of projects that I've worked on where those conversations haven't happened. They haven't happened early enough. You know, you kind of got to go around to a project and go, like, what do you want to achieve? How are you living in this? Is there anything that you don't like? And you can improve that. And that's kind of the comfort key and the energy efficiency key kind of come in. You know, one, you might be spending an awful lot of money on heating your house. But also if your house is getting boiling hot in the summer and freezing cold in the winter, you're not enjoying that space. And your house is one of, if not the biggest investment you make in your life. You sometimes have opportunities to, whether you're renovating it or you're putting an extension on, then maybe that's an opportunity at that moment to go, let's sort it out. So that's kind of why I'm kind of going down the specialism route. I think residential architecture, it's especially as a small single and, you know, practice, it's, I'm not going to be able to compete with larger practices on commercial builds. Because it's a different business-to-business interaction, really. I think I could do the work, but that's not really the way, I don't think that's the really way the majority of businesses really function. So you're going to be fighting in a different market. And it also means that I can have a clearer focus on who I want to talk to and how I speak to people about who I want to talk to. You know, there's kind of the elevator pitch side where, when you go to a networking event, when you explain your business, you don't want to be giving them a 5-minute conversation about all the skills you can do. You want to be giving them a snappy thing saying, you know, I help people with residential architecture. And, you know, if it's an existing building, I can help them with retrofit. Rather than, I've worked across education projects, ecclesiastical projects, conservation, all very different needs, all very different clients, kind of useful skills, but it's not a, it's not an easy sales package, I would say.
It's a good point. There's a few things that you mentioned there. So having a specialism makes it easier to hone in on your messaging with your elevator pitch, makes it easier to be able to package up your services in a way that makes sense. Also, you mentioned this practical point there with just the size of the practice, that as a small practice starting out, that, you know, it wouldn't make sense to be pitching for like a skyscraper or a new hospital. So obviously those smaller size projects make sense in the first instance. And the other thing you mentioned was about being a growing market for that. And I think that's something that I think we could all agree on that given the state of Britain's housing stock and housing crisis and climate change and all of those factors, that it would seem that that's only going to grow. I think that it's just, there probably needs to be a little bit more awareness with the general public that might be considering perhaps a regular home extension project or renovation that might not be aware of the opportunity that they have with that property to really improve its energy efficiency and comfort by going for a more of a retrofit project. So we probably, as architects and architectural technologists, have a responsibility to educate the general public on that, because if we don't educate them on it, nobody else is going to do it. I think you've got some really interesting specialisms there. Ian, I also wanted to ask about getting clients, essentially. I know this is early days for you, but could you perhaps tell me how you got your first clients, or if you've got any recommendations for us on getting clients?
There's a mixture of approaches. I think if you've got the opportunity to try and leverage previous working relationships as much as you can, because they're people that have an understanding of your skill in the market, and as a new business, you don't have that kind of background. You know, I think direct interaction is probably the key. Is, you know, the majority of my main winning is through directly reaching out to people and kind of entering into a conversation and having a chat with them and getting my foot in the door. I'm doing a lot of other things around that in kind of long-term preparation or in end of business positioning and kind of business. They might have a nice conversation and they look you up. At least, you know, that's why the website and social media is there, is because it gives me the kind of the social kind of brand. Like, I'm a proper business. I'm running a business. It exists. I'm trialing using online platforms, like an online lead generation platform. I'm giving it a go. I've made a financial investment in it, and it's you know, it's not generated any income as of yet, but it's generating some leads that might go somewhere. And you've also got to think about, as a new business, take as many opportunities as you can, as early as you can, because you're refining your ability to win clients. So even if you go to even if you don't win a project, the fact that you've gone through the process of having a chat with a client, reflect on that chat, think about why you may not have gotten that. You know, it might not be the right project for you, might be the right client. That's fine. But kind of see the wins in also or like in the failures almost. So a lot of the things I'm approaching is just, you know, even networking, it's improving that elevator pitch. It's kind of your ability to talk to people and kind of get them on side. You've just got to take any opportunity, knock on as many doors.
I love that. Take every opportunity. I like the knocking on doors, the fact that you talked about the direct outreach as well. I think sometimes in business, there's a tendency sometimes to do the things that feel comfortable and easy, when particularly when it comes to lead generation. And somebody may say, oh, I don't understand. Like, I've been posting like every day on Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn for like the last 3 months, and I've not got any leads out of it. There's the thing that type of stuff, it can help build some brand awareness, but it can be quite difficult to get clients from that, particularly if you don't have a really robust follow-up from posting on social media and then engaging directly in conversation with them, either in the DMs or taking it to virtual coffee or taking them out for a coffee, that sort of thing. Yeah. So I think I like the point that you made, Ian, about your existing network as well, that if you've got existing connections, that if you're starting out on your own, to basically get over any kind of pride that you might have and reach out to past employers, like the people that you've already worked with that know you, they already know, like, and trust you. They've already had experience of your work and expertise. There's nothing wrong with doing a little bit of subcontract work for a couple of other practices while you're getting yourself better established. And actually that can be, depending on your niche or specialism, if it's something where maybe your niche is something that you have a passion for, but maybe on its own isn't, maybe not financially sustainable in your area, that actually having that for the work that you're passionate about and then supplementing it with something else like some contract work can actually make something viable that wasn't before. It can actually become a sustainable business. You can get a lot of repeat work that way as well. Sometimes it can be, might have a project that isn't a good fit for them and they pass it straight on to you anyway. So yeah, absolutely. Leverage those connections. Ian, if someone was thinking of setting up their own practice, I mean, is there any sort of final recommendation you'd like to leave them with? What would be the number one thing that you would recommend that they do if they're thinking of setting up a practice?
Kind of go for it, I suppose. There's only one way of doing it, and it's kind of job Ian. Like if you feel like you're going to regret it, you've just got to kind of do it. Otherwise, there'll always be a reason not to. There's never going to be the right time. And even if it fails, don't be scared of it failing, because you're not, once you understand or realize why it's not worked. And there's so many examples of successful business owners that have failed. The reason why they got to where they got was because they happened to fail and they didn't let that stop them. And they reflected on it and they changed what they did, and it ended up being something more successful.
I love that. Yeah, there's well documented that there's so many hugely successful businesses that the business owners had multiple failed businesses prior to that, but they learned from the failures and applied that. It was just sort of just discovered another way that doesn't work. So it's a success. And then move on to the next one. Ian, is there anything else you wanted to add that we haven't covered in the conversation?
Just absorb as much as you can from anyone and try. There's a lot of things on maybe like lead generation that you can take with a pinch of salt, I think. There's a lot of things about LinkedIn or Instagram lead generation or ways to post and things like that. And there's a lot of people kind of selling kind of, you know, snake oil, I think, out there. And you've just got to find your way and then see what works. And I think probably your bit of advice, which is fail fast, just kind of constantly reflect and look, you know, if that's not working, then you're a small business owner, you're in complete control. Change it.
I love that. Yeah. I think look at it like you're running a series of sort of short experiments, just experimenting with a few different tactics to find the one that works. And you're absolutely right about there's so much out there for like lead generation, particularly around like social media and running paid ads, that sort of thing. And they do work for some businesses and they might work for you, but they might not. And that's the thing. You don't know. Just because it's worked for one other business, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for you and your business. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. It's just recognizing that you might just need to give it a certain period of time to trial it out and then decide whether it's going to work or not moving forward. That's really great advice. So thanks for that, Ian, for sharing your thoughts there. There's just another question I'd like to ask. It's the one I ask all of the guests. I love to travel and to discover new places. And I just wondered if you could share one of your favourite places and just tell us what you love about it.
I think I lived in London for a few years, and I think it's just an interesting fun place. And I'm planning to stay. We went there last summer with the kids. They got to see like Natural History Museum and just explore. Even things like the Tube is fun to them. So. There's always so much to do there and so many things to see. Yeah, so I'm going to go to London.
London's absolutely fantastic. I love it. I sometimes, where every time I go and visit London, I always think, why don't I come here more often? Because I always have such a good day out and there's so much to see there. I don't know who it was that said it, but they say, you know, you're bored with London, bored with life. Like you could do something different there every weekend for a whole year and still not see everything. And there is a lot you can do there for free as well, actually, that you can go for a family day out and it doesn't necessarily, I mean, it can cost a fortune depending on what you do, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Places like you say, the Natural History Museum, the Science Museum, great places to go and visit. Ian, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. So thank you so much for your time. Could you remind everybody where to find you online? Where's the best place to connect with you?
For professionals, you know, connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm always open for a chat and kind of, you know, quite happy to just be a bit of a sounding board. Or you can check out my website, which is www.iconic-architecture.com.
Dr.co.uk.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, I am on Instagram and on a variety of other ones, but it's, yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best place to contact me.
Awesome. I'll put a link to the website in the show notes so that people can find you via that site. Okay. So thanks again, Ian.
No, thanks. It's been a good chat.
Next time, I'll be chatting with Ray Brown about foundational business education. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Architecture Business Club. If you liked this episode, think other people might enjoy it, or just want to show your support for the show, then please leave a glowing 5-star review or rating wherever you listen to podcasts. It would mean so much to me and makes it easier for new listeners to discover the show. And if you haven't already done so, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss another episode. If you want to connect with me, you can do that on most social media platforms. Just search for @MrJohnClayton. The best place to connect with me online, though, is on LinkedIn. You can find a link to my profile in the show notes. Remember, running your architecture business doesn't have to be hard, and you don't need to do it alone. This is Architecture Business Club.